Tom M. from Lake Marina.
Oh, my name is Tom M. I usually use my last name, but I've been asked not to tonight, so I won't. From Lake Marina, California, which is up by Campo, for those who don't know. Campo. It's good to see some familiar faces in here. I first also would like to thank Larry and Christina, although I've never met Christina. And I'd like to welcome our newcomers, as somebody says, as we all say, welcome home. And I'd like to congratulate those people who celebrated birthdays tonight, April and Alfredo. And our 90-day wonder, is it Daniel? Is that the name? Very good. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Our stories disclose in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what we are like now. These are my books. My sobriety date is January 19th, 1995. Oops, this thing's going to want to move. When I speak, I like to walk around, but I obviously can't do that. It makes me feel more at ease. And Mandy, you did a great job, right? You know, it all started, I'm 61 years old. I sobered up 2 months before my 45th birthday. And I was born in Los Angeles. I was raised in a pretty affluent family. Bel Air. My father was a mega automobile dealer. And he didn't spoil us, though. He said, what's mine is mine, is what's your, and what's yours is what you're going to earn. So, you know, he taught us some ethics. There's five of us. Two of us are in the program. Three of my siblings are just normal people. You know, they can take a drink with impunity. But my older sister, I think she's 23 years sober, maybe 24, and then myself, which I'm 16. I can drive now. That's great. Anyway, wonder what's going to happen when I'm 21. But anyway, we had a relatively normal life. My mother was an alcoholic. My father was a heavy drinker and a wife abuser. And a very hard kind of guy. Towards the end of the, can you guys hear me back there all right? Okay. Towards the end of his life, though, he changed. My mother died of alcoholism. My stepmother died of brain cancer. And I'll get into that stuff in a little while. My father passed away about 5 or 6 years ago. And he passed away, and we were on great terms. And I'll get into that a little bit later, too. But my mother had, or I should say my parents had, this liquor cabinet at home. And I started to experiment with alcohol at a very young age. My first memory is probably about 12 or 13 years old. And the first drink I ever took was a sip of sherry out of the bottle. And that didn't go over too well. As it went down my throat, it started to burn. And in my stomach, it started to burn. But it was exciting. And I took another sip. And I would do that, and I would play with these bottles for the next couple of years. And you know how we do that. You know, I'd kind of graduate to other things like scotch and whiskey and vodka and stuff like that. And I'd put a little water back in them so they know I wasn't drinking it. But I got caught, you know. So anyway, no big deal. No, Mom, I'll never do it again. I went to school at St. Paul the Apostle in West Los Angeles. I'm a Catholic, a mackerel snapper, although I left my religion probably at about 15 years old, and I returned to my religion when I got sober. So I was away from it for almost 30 years. In the seventh grade, I met a girl. I had this thing for older women, even at a young age, and she took me over to her house, and we were drinking. And it was kind of strange because the nuns found out about it, and they got a little perturbed about it. And I used to crawl through the fence to get to this girl's house. But her father didn't care, which was kind of weird, you know. And what am I, 14 years old or something like that? 13 years old? And, you know, really, again, very little impunity. You know, a slap on the hand, don't do that again. But, you know, and we stopped seeing each other more or less after a few months. Then I went to high school, Loyola High School in Los Angeles. Played football. Undefeated freshman. Pretty good. But in my sophomore year, I'm dating another woman. I think I'm 16 or 15 and a half, and she's 17, and she's picking me up from school in her car. Her license plate, RIR121. I'll never forget that license plate. Her parents were psychologists. You know? Anyway, right before my graduation, my sophomore year, the priest said, "You're out of here." Because of some disciplinarian problems, because of the fact that I was hanging out with this girl who was picking me up, and they frowned upon it. So that really started to mess things up. I ended up going to 5 high schools. I finally got a GED degree, and I really liked college. And I went to agricultural school up in Los Angeles, Pierce Junior College. Did a little bit of study at San Luis Obispo, Cal Poly. And all this whole time I started getting into music. I used to hang out in Hollywood with my friends. My bed was underneath a kitchen table at 555 Sunset Avenue in Venice Beach. I pretty much left home off and on between those, you know, the 15 and 16 years of age. Started doing my own thing. But, you know, I'd come back, get money, you know, go out and do that old stuff again. And, you know, I got into rock and roll. Hollywood. Bells on my boots and all that stuff, you know. And there was a lot of things going on there, and I don't really want to get into them, but I did other things other than drink. But I started with alcohol. Okay, that's where it all started, and it all ended with alcohol. Anyway, I studied music, and I still play music today. As a matter of fact, I'm a music director at a church, but leave that aside. I left Los Angeles in 1968 at the age of 18 years old, and I moved to Colorado, where my cousin was the manager of a restaurant called the Starboard Tack in Denver, Colorado. And I got a job there as a busboy, and then I got a job there as a waiter. And my drinking at that point, although it was relatively regular up for, you know, for a couple of years up until that point, it started getting real heavy, and I started hanging out with a group of people that were not good for me. But I enjoyed it. I was having fun. Sex, booze and rock and roll and all that stuff. Staying out late. Married a gal, again an older woman. Moved to San Diego in 1972. We divorced. I was drinking too much. She didn't want to be around me. But again, I got a job at across the street from the Chart House. I forget what it was called. I can't think of the name of the restaurant, but it was owned by a couple of guys, and I was a bartender then. And that didn't last very long. Came back to Orange County for a little while, worked for my dad in one of his automobile dealerships, and then came back to San Diego. Met another gal, got married. She drank, so this was a little bit better. We drank together, and we drank a lot, and it was serious stuff. But I was a functioning alcoholic. You know, I had a job. I was paying bills. And I was drinking and just having a great old time. And this went on for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. And we got divorced. That didn't last. She wanted a lot of money. You know, so we bought a car. She had to have the car. She had to have some money. I didn't have any money, but I gave her whatever I had just to get her off my back. And you know, just to continue to do what we do. I drank and I drank and I drank. And I met another woman who, this woman's 4 years younger than I am, although we're born on the same day. And we're still married today. We have 3 kids and we have 4 grandkids. But anyway, I met this woman. We married in 1987. And, you know, I was drinking. I was working. I was drinking. I was working. I'd come home, I'd pass out, I'd go to work. And this went on for about 7 years. Like I said, my story is no different than anybody else. I could not control and enjoy my drinking. There was an old guy named Big Book Sam that used to do a speaker tour. He said, when I was enjoying it, I wasn't controlling it. When I wasn't controlling it, I wasn't enjoying it. I could not control my drinking. Countless vain attempts to prove that I could drink like other people. Yeah, right. At the parties, The party's over. I'm smashed. I can't drive. My wife's going to have to drive me home. Oh, there's a couple of glasses left on the tables. Oh, there's a cigarette butt in there. Just take it out and drink it. I mean, that's kind of what it was. I did get one DUI. I did go to jail twice. I've been in the hospital twice, all alcoholic related. Did that stop me from drinking? No. I'm an alcoholic. I'm supposed to drink. But anyway, it's just the way it is. The real part of my story begins, other than the fact that we're all the same, we all drink, you know, and some of us more than others, but we know we're here as a result of our drinking, and a bottom. On September 26th, 1994, I came home from work. I had bought a house in 1978, and I moved my wife down there from Los Angeles, and I think it was 1987 when we did that, but on September 26, 1994, I came home from work, and the moving vans were in front of the house. I've had enough. You're an alcoholic. You need help, and I'm not going to watch you die. Those were her words. She got in the truck. She left San Diego and went to Montana with the children. She had a sister that lived up there and a brother-in-law. And, of course, I was furious. What are you doing? You can't talk to me like that. Don't you know who I am? You know, there's nothing wrong with me. You're the problem. You know this? You're the problem. For the next 4 months, it really got ugly. At that point, I was unemployed now. The guy that I work for today fired me in August of 94, just a month before she left. I got a job, but it really wasn't a very good job. The guy was nice enough to hire me. He knew I had some issues, but, you know, he thought maybe I could help the store, so he hired me. But I was like, you know, at that point, I was not a functioning alcoholic. I was just an alcoholic that was unreliable, undependable, and nonproductive. Unemployed, broke. The bank wants the house. The credit card companies are calling. Everybody wants money. I owed $40,000 when that woman left, and the bank wanted the house. I borrowed some money from some friends to kind of keep the wolves away from the door, so to speak. But it still didn't stop me from drinking. I rented out part of the house to a woman with three kids. My God, was that a mistake. And this woman, God bless her soul, I mean, she was a mess. I mean, I don't know, she wasn't an alcoholic, but she was a mess, an emotional mess. And I couldn't handle that, but, you know, I finally came to my knees two different times. I mentioned the hospital. I don't remember if it was my sister or my neighbor across the street. My neighbor had, was concerned about my well-being. And I was talking to somebody on the phone, and evidently I'd blacked out. And I wasn't a blackout drinker. I would drink and not remember a lot of things that I did, but I didn't really black out. I mean, I did black out once in a while, but I wasn't a blackout drinker, as they say. You know, every time I drank, I blacked out. No, I didn't. But I didn't remember everything either. Anyway, I'm on the phone. And gee, I forgot what I was saying. No. I'm on the phone, and I pass out. I black out, whatever. I don't know what happened. And the next thing I know, there's two paramedics in my house put me on a gurney. And I'm not very lucid, but anyway, they haul me off to Paradise Valley Hospital. And I remember the nurse asking me to sign a document. I was shaking so bad I couldn't do anything, and I just put an X there. And that's all I could do. They took me in, they cleaned me up, I guess. You know, all I know is at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I called a cab. I snuck out of the hospital, and I went back home. And what do you think I did? I started drinking again. 72 hours later. Again, I don't know if it was my neighbor or my sister. The same thing happened. My neighbor tells me the story. That's the same two guys that picked me up 3 days before. And they said, "Oh, no, not you again." I don't know. That's what I was told, so I'm taking it, you know, that's what happened. This time I went to Grossmont, and I had had a pretty bad fall because I had a pretty good gash on my head. The doctor looked at me and said, "I'm not going to sew you up because I want you to remember this gash and where it came from." I said, "Okay." Anyway, I don't remember how I got home, but I got home that night, and what do you think I did again? I stopped at the liquor store, bought more booze, and started drinking again. The next morning was January 19th, 1995. Now, I got to throw something in here. I did not drink beer. I drank because I liked the effect produced by alcohol. When I drank, I wanted to drink and get going. You know, get it on. People talk about recycling. I started recycling a long time ago because I was so damn embarrassed that the trash man picking up my empty bottles at the curbside would say, "This guy's a freaking drunk. He's got a problem. He's going to call the cops on this guy." So I'd always take my bags into the recycling guy with all the bottles. I didn't care about the money. I'd just leave them there and leave. So I started recycling a long time ago. Anyway, at least that kind of recycling. You know, fortunately, I don't have to do that anymore. I always got a kick out of that, though. Anyway, 1995, January 19th, I walk into the Lemon Grove Alarm Club. Actually, I didn't walk in. I could not do anything. I called central office. They sent two guys to pick me up. God bless them. You know, I don't remember their names, but they took me to the Lemon Grove Alarm Club. Now, can I use somebody's last name who's passed away? Okay. I walk into the Lemon Grove Alarm Club. And there's a very back table by the door on the west side where the bathroom is. And there's a guy sitting there named Marshall Hall. And he looked at me and he laughed at me. He said, "You look like S-H-I-T. I didn't know you were one of us." And you know what? I haven't a clue what's going on because I'm just so spaced. But I sat down and I listened and I raised my hand as a newcomer. I had tried a little bit of AA in those 4 months between the time my wife had left and that January 19th date, September 26, 1994. It's a day I'll never forget, just like my sobriety day, my birthday, like my wedding anniversary, things like that, kids' birthdays. And I remember, you know, going back to that four-month period, I had to, because of the DUI, I had to go to mandatory meetings. In those days, they really didn't check the slips, the signed court slips, you know. So I'd be signing my own court slips. But I did have to go and visit with Buzzard at these educational things. I guess he's still around there, but at least that's what I've heard. I walked in the Mira Mesa Alano Club, and there was a lady sitting there, and there was a guy sitting there, and then there was me. And all I remember is this lady stunk like she'd been drinking. And I'm going, "What's this all about? You know, I don't want to be here. This lady reeks of alcohol." Now, before I went to that meeting, I stopped and got a couple of airplane bottles before I walked in. And I'm sure between that and the night before, I was reeking of alcohol. So isn't that kind of funny? You know, I think about that, how ironic that was. I wonder if she thought that about me. Anyway, I got up and I walked out of the meeting. And I went to a few others, but, it didn't do any good. You know, I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready until that January 19th. Anyway, Marshall Hall, you know, what a great guy. I love the guy, you know, and he had a lot to do with my sobriety. He used to talk about the nine-step promises a lot. Anyway, thus began my journey. I had a sponsor who passed away a few years ago, Frank Lauer, who would have been 37 years sober, I think 38 years sober, July 31st this year. And he taught me a lot. The first thing that I needed to do was get busy. Get busy. Jewel J said I needed to go to a step study meeting. So I found, he said, "Go to the Porter Hall meeting on Thursday night." So I started doing that. I got a sponsor, and he says, "Okay, you need a service commitment. What do you want me to do? You're making coffee." I mean, I was making coffee, I think, 4 days sober, you know. I had a group of meetings. If you're not comfortable in one, excuse me, go to another one. I found a group of meetings that I was very comfortable with. Even though I live in Lake Marina, I work in San Diego, I have a bunch of meetings that I'm comfortable with, and I still go to a bunch of different meetings. I'm still involved in a step study. That's why this book is held together with rubber bands. But anyway, and every time I read something, I'm going, I don't remember reading that, you know. But anyway, there used to be an old guy named Frank Fahey. He used to come down from La Jolla to the Lemon Grove Lana Club. And John LaFontaine, who recently passed away, great guy. But Frank Fahey stood at the podium one day at the Lemon Grove Lana Club, and he read the foreword to the 12 and 12. And he said, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, that if practiced as a way of life can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to live a happily useful and whole life. When I heard that, I said, oh, my God. I got to backtrack a little bit because they talk about a spiritual awakening. Frank had taken me down to the VOA on that January 19th. I think it was a Tuesday. I'd have to go back and look. And it was a Thursday. And he took me to the VOA, and I spent 3 days there. And I had a spiritual experience there that was really phenomenal. I was sitting in the back room reading the Bible. And I was reading Psalm 13. And I'm just going to briefly repeat it. How long, O Lord, will you forget me? Forever? How long, O Lord, will you hide your face from me? Forever? How long, O Lord, must I wrestle with my thoughts and have sorrow in my heart? Forever? How long, O Lord, will my enemy triumph over me? Forever? When I read that line, I realized the enemy was not the alcohol. It was me. I was the enemy. We believe that most of our problems are of our own making. I was the enemy. When that happened, there was a guy in that room, and he looked at me and he said, are you okay? I got, you know, goosebumps right now. I said, you got to read this. He said, you look like you're glowing. I said, you got to read this. I'll never forget that moment. But anyway, getting back to Frank, group of principles. It was advised to get a dictionary. I saw this word vicissitude in the chapter to the agnostic, and I'm going, what the heck does that mean? Look it up. Best one to get something around circa 1935 or 34, but I didn't, you know, I just looked it up. So if you don't know what the word is, look it up. But I'll tell you what the word principle is. Moral standards. A group of moral standards, spiritual. It's an interesting word in the dictionary. Of God and from God. So we've got a group of moral standards of God and from God. In their very nature, that if practiced as a way of life, will expel the obsession. The obsession is an interesting word. A morbid craving. Morbid, a death wish, a death craving. And enable the sufferer to live a happily and useful and whole, complete life. Somebody once asked me a question. How many does it take to make one? Half of two or two halves? I thought that was an interesting question. To be a whole human being and to give half of myself away to my wife till we can be whole in matrimony, it would be half of two. If I'm a half a human being like I was when I was drinking and try to give myself any kind of a meaningful relationship, which the book clearly defines, we've never been able to have any kind of a meaningful relationship with another person, there's nothing left of me. I'm empty. I'm gone. Anyway, when Fahey said that stuff, it really started me thinking about this program. The obsession to drink has been removed. The thought has not. And I think that's normal. Frank, my sponsor, used to say, I never think of it. Okay. You know, I'm watching NASCAR, you know. There's Blackjack and there's Budweiser and there's Coors, all this stuff. You know, I mean, I think about it. But I go right back recoil from it like a hand over a hot flame. Anyway, I admitted that I was powerless. It took me a little while to understand why I drank the way that I drank. Until I read the doctor's opinion. I think probably about the sixth time when it finally made sense to me. They talked about this allergy. An allergy dictionary definition means an abnormal reaction. I have an allergy to alcohol. When I introduce it into my body, it sets in motion a series of physiological, biological, psychological events I cannot control. And it creates this thing called a phenomenon of craving. Phenomenon means beyond human understanding. We don't know why it is what it is. So the only thing I can do is complete abstinence from alcohol. I once told a guy, I was at a party, and the guy offered me a drink, and I said, no thanks. And he says, are you sure? And I said, yeah, no, I'm allergic to alcohol. He says, oh, you're allergic to alcohol? I said, yeah. He says, you don't know what you're missing. I said, well, how can I miss anything if I don't know what I'm missing? You know, so whatever. I love the line. But anyway, if I go to a party and they ask me if I want a drink, I said no. If they ask me why, I tell them I'm allergic to alcohol. What happens? I break out in spots. Like poison oak, you know? That's the best way to. I don't have to tell them that I end up on the other side of the county, you know? My wife's also allergic to alcohol, but she doesn't drink. When she drinks it, her throat swells closed. So she, you know, great. Anyway, I got real busy in my deal, you know, and I'm real active in my sobriety. I'm real active participant in my sobriety. I'm proud to say that close to 6,000 days of sobriety, whatever the number is, 5,800, 5,900, I don't know what it is. I have had the opportunity to be of service to either Alcoholics Anonymous or the church every week of sobriety. Whether it's literature, whether it's coffee, whether it's secretary, whether it's treasurer, I'm a music director, I've sat on the board at the Heartland House, I've sat on the board at the Freedom Ranch, I resigned, Freedom Ranch. I had to resign because there's some things going on up there, some development going on up there, I didn't want it to blow back on the ranch because I had some issues with it. So, you know, and Glenn was great about it, and everybody's great about it. But, you know, service is really important because it takes you out of yourself. You know, it's an opportunity to get back. One of the best meetings I've ever been to, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, we were doing it with a guy named Terry and Bill. The third Thursday of every month, we used to go down to George Bailey and walk through 5 iron doors, and we got to leave. Thank God. But, I mean, that's pretty insane, you know, to talk to those people down there and to try to help them. The steps. Fear is an interesting word. We have a lot of acronyms in AA for fear. You know, one is F everything and run, face everything and recover, false evidence appearing real. There's another one I don't remember, but I made one up. Faith encourages and restores. Don't give up, just believe, you know. Everything will be all right. Whenever I get a little squirrely, you know, I think about that, and it takes me right back to step two. Father Bill Wilson, who passed away a few years ago, had three PhDs. He said, Chapter 4 in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is the most incredible thing he ever read. This guy's got 3 PhDs, you know? And I never read it because I didn't have a problem with God at that point, but I read it. And it kind of changed my perception about finding a power greater than myself which will solve my problem. He had to search fearlessly, but he was there. The nearer I drew to God, the nearer he drew to me. And I do that regularly. Step 3, you know, I'm on my knees every morning. And I make up my own prayers like, Father God, you who give so freely to those of us who pray for your love, direction, and guidance, return so little for your gifts. And it seems like a simple thank you isn't enough, so I pray for you to know that I hold you so very close to my heart, and all of your gifts are treasured in my soul and my spirit. Write a letter to God, memorize something, write your own prayers. You don't have to use formal prayers. He understands. I used to know a guy that used to pray to a palm tree. That lasted for a few years. And then he prayed to a God a little higher than the palm tree. Let's just put it that way. George, you know. And in the 12 and 12, it says, in fact, the effectiveness of the whole AA program will rest upon how well you have come to make that decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand them. It says it in the book. I believe personally, without God of some sort, good orderly direction, group of drunks, the great outdoors, whatever, it makes it more difficult. That's my opinion. But, you know, whatever. I don't know because I'm not there. I believe in God. Step four took me 4.5 months to do. It was thorough and it was fearless. And, you know, that little word fear appeared at the end of all the columns. It's kind of interesting. That evil corroding thread winding its way through just about every fabric of human existence. I was nervous coming up here. I'm okay now, you know. I'm nervous when I get up and have to do big things, you know, but it's all right. It goes away. It's not a big deal. I shared it with 2 priests, one twice, the other one once, and I shared the less steamy stuff with my sponsor. Confidentiality had a little bit to do with that, and the priest had a little confidentiality deal, so I don't want to go there, so let's leave it alone. So, you know, and when I did that, I did what the book said. Go back and reflect about all the steps you've previously done. I went and sat in church for an hour. And thought about it. Step 6 and 7. It says, this is the beginning of a lifetime process. Holy cow. Somebody once said, let's simplify this. Character defects are the things that you continue to do that you shouldn't be doing. Shortcomings are the things that we should be doing that we're not doing. We fall short of doing them. I kind of believe that 4, 5, 6, and 7, especially 6 and 7, might have something to do with 8, because when you want to make that list, you refer back to the 4th step, it says in the book. But we don't want to fall short of making that list. We don't want to fall short of making those amends. I paid back that $40,000. I did not file bankruptcy. I made a deal with the people. I paid them all back. I made amends. Start where it hurts the most. Family, friends and loved ones, employers, associates, things like that. I'm done with them except for one person where to do so would injure them or others. She's married. She's got a family. She lives in New York. She doesn't need to hear from me. Okay? I don't need to ruin that deal. 10, 11, and 12. Oh, by the way, there's a couple of lines in the 12 and 12 talk about chief activator of all of our character defects is self-centered fear. We get back to that fear thing. Fear, you know. Faith encourages and restores. Just believe, you know. And then it's a spiritual axiom. Axiom is an unarguable fact. It's a truism. So here we go. It's a spiritual axiom. It's an unarguable truth, a truism of and from God, that whenever I'm disturbed, there's something wrong with me, and I better take a look at myself. You know, whenever I do this, there's 3 pointing at me. We've all heard that before. 10, continue to take personal inventory. When I'm wrong, I admit it. I got in an argument with somebody at work last week. He accused me of taking money out of his pocket. Man, I got hot. And I tried to make an amends to the guy, and he says, I'm not going to take your amends. I like to hang on to grudges. I said, okay, that's fine. I've done my job. You do whatever you want to do. You know? I like to pray and meditate, you know. Down the street here, I don't know which direction I'm headed in, but anyway, the first 2 years of my sobriety, I was very fortunate to belong to a group of people called Contemplative Outreach of San Diego. It's first century prayer and meditation. It's also called centering prayer. And, you know, it started with a small group of about 14 or 15 of us, and I understand there's like 40 or 50 weekly prayer meetings in San Diego County right now. You can go to a website, contemplativeoutreachofsandiego.org. It's pretty fascinating stuff. I've learned how to meditate. I believe it or not, I can turn this thing off when I want to. I sit at home. I'm at 3,500 feet. I look up in the sky. I'm in a jacuzzi, and I'm going, wow. Look at all the freaking stars. Look at what's going on, you know. I mean, it just blows me away. I memorized that St. Francis prayer. It's a pretty powerful prayer. Grant that I may seek rather to comfort than to be comforted, to understand than to be understood, to love than to be loved. For it's by self-forgetting, It's by dying to self that we find ourselves. It's by forgiving that we are forgiven. It's by dying to self that we find self. Chuck Chamberlain's got a great book in his word, in a line of his new pair of glasses. You can't think yourself into better living. You have to live yourself into better thinking. That's hard to do. The book says, although he was adult in years, his behavior was still childish. I'm growing up. I believe I walked into these rooms with the maturity, the emotional maturity of a 13-year-old child. Today I'm a 61-year-old man. I don't know if I'm 61 yet, but I'm older than 13 now, emotionally. Mentally, physically, and spiritually. Four deals. And, you know, the 12th step is, I love the line in the books on page 102. Your job now is to go to anywhere. Let's go back to 77 first. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. 77 says, our real purpose is to be of maximum usefulness to God and to the other people about us. And 102 says, it's now my job to carry the message of recovery to anyone who would hear it. You'd go to the most sordid spots on earth, prisons, you know, whatever, downtown, to carry the message of alcohol, recovery to an alcoholic. And it also says, burn into the consciousness of every man or woman that they can get sober. They just trust God, clean house, and work with other alcoholics. My spirit has awakened. It still awakens. As a protection against big shotism, I have to remember that I'm only sober today by the grace of God, and any success that I have is more His than mine. Any success that I have is more His than mine. Pain and suffering, the failures, are redemptive. It says pain is a touchstone to spiritual progress. None of us are perfect. We all got issues. And you know what? It's okay. It's okay. We just, you know, we say in meetings, progress, not perfection. But there's a word that's in front of progress. It says spiritual progress. Spiritual progress, progress of and from God. Carry the message, you know, and it talks about it. You know, just all the little stuff that's going on in this meeting's huge. There's a whole bunch of actors in this meeting that are involved in this meeting. They're all doing service work. And it's a great thing to comfort, to understand, to love, which is what we do. To end the story, my wife came back. In November of 96. I drove to Montana in November of 96. Does anybody know what it's like in Montana in November of 96? Holy cow. Anyway, I rented a U-Haul. And she was in a little town called Glasgow, which is up near Canada. I think 50 miles south of the Canadian border, something like that. We didn't make it out of town. We had a blizzard. She wouldn't sleep with me for about 4 or 5 months because she didn't trust me yet. But I needed to make her understand something. I love you. I love our children. But my sobriety, my God, hand in glove, my God, my sobriety, I don't care how you want to flip it, is more important than my family. Because without my sobriety, without my God, I wouldn't have a family. She didn't like that at first. She understands that now. My job is probably somewhere around 6 or 7. The guy that fired me in 94 hired me back in 2000. I've been with him for almost 11 years. I'm trying to retire. He won't let me retire. He keeps waving these green pieces of paper in front of me. My life is completely turned around. I walk in here. I was broke, terror, frustration, bewilderment, and despair. Today, I'm happy, joyous, and free for the most part. You know, there's money in the bank. The bills are paid. I bought another house. I bought property in New Mexico. I got another piece of property in Northern California. I have some investments. I have income coming in, not necessarily from work, from other sources. And, yeah, my dad left us a little bit, you know, but he didn't leave us any cash. He just left us some assets, and we're trying to manage them responsibly. the five of us, and we get along fine. We just got back from New Mexico. So here's the end of the story, almost. I think I got like 2 or 3 minutes left. I have 7 acres in Lake Marina. I'm in the phone book. Tom and Kathy, well, I guess I can't do that. But if you need my phone number and you want to come visit us, that's fine. When the kids got old and left the house, my wife needed something to do. So she bought a dog. She bought a border collie. First one came from Animal Rescue, and then she wanted another one. This one we bought. Dog came from Atlanta, Georgia. $500 dog, I think, is what we paid for it. And she takes this dog into agility. Does everybody know what agility is? Okay. Is it where they go over the sticks and go through the chutes and they jump over this? Anyway, she loved it. She had to have another dog. So we didn't buy it. She bred the dog. Now I got another dog. And then she went to a sheep herding trial. They're called field trials, big trials. You need a big property to do that. When we were looking, I said, what do you need, about 5 acres? No, I need more than 5 acres. I said, 10? No, I don't need that much. How about 7.5? That's fine. I got her 7.5 acres. Actually, it's 7.3, but anyway. Now she does sheepdog trials. And no, now we need another dog. Well, to make a long story short, I got 10 dogs. I got one cat. I got a wife. And what do we think I need to use to use for the dogs to be trained to do sheep herding? Sheep. I got 35 freaking sheep. I think it's close to 50 mouths I have to feed every day. So if you wonder, you know, why we're like this, you know, I was out working all day today. You know, I do my own thing. We had somebody from the ranch come over and help. You know, I like to do that, I am so grateful that I've had the opportunity to share my experience, strength, and hope with you guys. You know, like I said, my wife's back, the kids are grown, now we got 4 grandkids, the daughter's living in the house that she was raised in with her 2 kids, the other daughter's living out in Santee with her 2 kids. She's divorced, but the other one's married. My son's 24 years old, we just started a business together. We do t-shirts and hats, promotional items, if anybody's interested in them. He's kind of staying with us until we get him a little better on his feet, then we'll rent him an apartment. You know, life is good. In my wildest dreams, I got a God box. In my God box, I have to give credit to a guy by the name of Philip Steffen. Philip Steffen was a World War II vet. He was one of the first people I met in the Lemon Grove Alana Club. He used to drag me around all San Diego County, all these meetings in his little Volkswagen Rabbit that said, protected by Smith & Wilson, not Smith & Wesson. And before he passed away, I gave him his last 3 tokens, I think. I was 42, 43, and 44 years, I think, of sobriety. And I think I was only 2 or 3, 4 years of sober at the time. I said, why are you asking me, who am I to be giving you these tokens for this amount of sobriety? He said, Tom, all we have is today. All we have is today. Yesterday's history, tomorrow's a mystery, today is a gift. That's why we call it the present. All we have is today. So his 44-year token is sitting in my God box. He asked me to keep it for him. He said, you'll get there. I'm going, let's not go there, Phil. Let's not go there, Phil. One of the beautiful things that I've had an opportunity to do is meet a lot of people. In 1995, they had the big international convention down here, and I still have my little vest, my little yellow hat, Sunshine of the Spirit. But I was fortunate enough to hear a speaker on a tape, a guy by the name of Dooley Stearns, who actually got sober in San Diego in the 40s. We went to Montana, and this poem's been around for a long time. Some of you may have heard it, some of you may not have heard it, but I'm going to read it to you. And if I get a little teary-eyed, please understand. It's anonymous. I dreamed one night I passed away and left the world behind and started down that lonesome trail some of my friends to find. I came to a signboard on the trail and the directions it did tell. Turn right to go to heaven, turn left to go to hell. Now I hadn't been too good on earth, just a hopeless boozing rake, and knew there at the crossroads the path I'd have to take. So I started up that rocky path that leads to Satan's place, and shook my head within, not knowing what I'd have to face. Oh, Satan met me at the gate and said, "What's your name, my friend?" I said, I'm just old sober Sam that's come to a sad, sad end. And he glanced through some old yellow files and said, you've made a mistake, I fear. You're listed as an alcoholic, and you're not wanted here. I said, I'm looking for some of my friends. And a smile stole over his face. If your friends are alcoholics, they're in the other place. So I went back down the way I came till the crossroads I did see, then turned right to heaven as happy as could be. St. Peter said, come in, for you I have a berth. You're an alcoholic, and you've been through hell on earth. And I saw old Dave and Ken and Bill C. and a friend called Bill. And brother, I was tickled because I thought, sure, they'd gone to hell. So brothers, all take warning, and sisters, and learn something from my trip. You've got a place in heaven if you try hard not to slip. If someone tempts you with a drink when you're not feeling well, just tell them you're going to heaven, and he can go to hell.